This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. I'll be reading parts of the May chapter of the book by Douglas Tallamy, The Nature of Oaks, The Rich Ecology of Our Most Essential Native Trees. In the prologue, he writes, "Oaks support more forms of life and more fascinating interactions than any other tree genus in North America." And at the end, I'll talk about Eric Wood, avian ecologist, and his research at the Kickapoo Valley Reserve and Fort McCoy on oaks and spring migrant warblers' foraging behavior. Now, parts of the May chapter. I'm not very good at foreign languages. Okay, I'm terrible at them. Nor am I good at deciphering bird songs. I'm convinced the two talents are related. Fortunately for me, though, Cindy is excellent at both. So when she excitedly whispers, "Magnolia in the front oak," I pay attention. In fact, I grab my camera. I know Cindy has heard one of our prettiest migrants, the magnolia warbler. During peak migration in May, Cindy doesn't whisper just about magnolia warblers. Last spring, within one 30-minute stretch, she alerted me to a northern parula, a black-throated green, a black and white, and a magnolia, all warblers foraging in our oak tree. We do not live on a major migratory flyway, but red starts, yellow warblers, blue-gray gnatcatchers, white and red-eyed vireos, hermit thrushes, indigo buntings, Canada warblers, Baltimore and orchard orioles, eastern kingbirds, ovenbirds, Kentucky warblers, common yellow throats, and blackpoll warblers regularly stop in our yard while on their way to breeding grounds farther north. They stop for one primary reason, to eat. There are 650 species of birds that breed in North America. More than half, some 350 species, in fact, are long-distant migrants, birds that spend up to 7 months of each year in the tropics, but fly thousands of miles north to reproduce. It may seem puzzling that they should make such an effort. The physiological strain on migrants is difficult to comprehend. Migrants lose as much as 35% of their body weight if their migration route takes them over the Atlantic Ocean or across the Gulf of Mexico, and many die of exhaustion before they make landfall. Once in North America, they can fly 300 miles in a single night if they have a tailwind, but when they stop for the day to rest, they must also refuel. In spring, the energy that fuels migration comes primarily from insects rich in fats and proteins. In fact, a migrant will increase its body weight 30 to 50% each day they spend in stopover sites by eating insects. That is, if there are enough insects to eat. And then there are challenges from uncooperative weather conditions, particularly from storms and stalled fronts in the spring and hurricanes in the fall. In short, migration is the most dangerous and taxing thing a bird will do in its lifetime. Yet, as with any other life history trait, the ecological benefits of migrating north during the spring to breed and then back south to the tropics for the fall and winter must have outweighed the costs, or the behavior would not have evolved in any bird species, let alone in hundreds of them. And indeed, when migration evolved, the benefits did outweigh the costs. Birds that flew north to rear young could raise more offspring than birds that didn't. Ever since the most recent glaciers retreated, and during every interglacial period before that, the temperate zone offered something to birds that the tropics did not: a nearly inexhaustible supply of insects. Each spring across North America, there was an explosion of fresh, tender foliage that was followed closely by an explosion of the insects that ate that foliage, a resource bonanza for birds that reared their young on insects. According to the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, birds that migrated north to take advantage of this enormous pulse of food could raise 4 to 6 young each year, a much better reproductive output than the 2 or 3 offspring their tropical relatives could muster, and apparently worth the dangers and stress of the migration required to do so. And so the evolution of bird migration was triggered and sustained for millennia, at least in part, by the seasonal flush of insects in the temperate zone. Some ornithologists hypothesize that lower predation rates in the temperate zone also played a role in the evolution of migration. Regardless, migration could continue to be a viable strategy as long as migrants are able to balance mortality from risky migration with enhanced reproduction once they arrive in breeding grounds. This, however, still requires diverse and abundant insects everywhere birds need to breed, for it is those insects that migrants turn into baby birds, and therein lies the problem. Wherever we have reduced the absolute number of plants in an area or replaced the native plants that support insects with non-native plants that do not, insect populations and thus the ability of migrants to balance their risk equation have been devastated. Devastated is a strong word, but at the University of Delaware, my students and I have been measuring the impact of invasive and ornamental non-native plants on insects and the birds that need them for over 15 years. We have the numbers to back this statement up. The magnitude of the impact non-native plants have on caterpillars is illustrated well by a study Melissa Richard, Adam Mitchell, and I conducted recently. We measured what happens to caterpillars when non-native plants displace native plants in agricultural hedgerows. Finding hedgerows that were thoroughly invaded by introduced plants, such as autumn olive, multiflora rose, calorie pear, porcelain berry, burning bush, and bush honeysuckle, was easy. They typify the, quote, natural areas near the University of Delaware, where we did our study. The trick was finding hedgerows that were still relatively free of invasive plants, using a combination of restored sites and areas not easily accessed by deer, which exacerbate the spread of invasive plants. We finally found what we were looking for, 4 invaded sites and 4 primarily native sites of similar size. Using replicated transects, we counted and weighed caterpillars at each site, once in June and again in late July. By every measure, the caterpillar community was seriously diminished when introduced plants replaced native plants. Even though there was more plant biomass within the invaded hedgerows, there were 68% fewer caterpillar species, 91% fewer caterpillars, and 96% less caterpillar biomass than what we recorded in native hedgerows. To summarize these numbers in terms of the everyday needs of the animals that eat caterpillars, we found 96% less food available in the invaded habitats. What do such reductions mean for caterpillar eaters? It's not rocket science to assume that if there is less food available in a habitat, there will be fewer creatures that need that food. If you doubt that logic, fill your bird feeders and then count the number of birds that use those feeders for a day. The next day, repeat your bird counts, but put out only 4% of the seed your feeders can hold. Your birds will clean out your feeders in short order, and then they will leave. If they were depending on those feeders to rear young, their babies would starve. Or more likely, your birds would know there wasn't enough food to rear young successfully before they laid eggs, so they would not even try to reproduce in your yard. The problem, of course, is that most birds do not rear their young on seeds from our feeders or from any place else, or for that matter, on fruits from local bushes. They rear their young on insects and spiders that themselves needed insects to become spiders. And the overwhelming majority of the insects that become bird food will not be in our yards unless we have the native plant species on which to grow those insects. And the overwhelming majority of the insects that become bird food will not be in our yards unless we have the native plant species on which those insects depend for growth and reproduction. As logical as it is to assume that birds need adequate amounts of food to sustain their populations, we no longer have to make this assumption. My student, Desiree Narango, for the first time has measured the impact of non-native plants on bird reproduction in suburban yards. using Carolina chickadees as model birds that do their best to breed in human-dominated landscapes and our nation's capital as a stereotypical suburban habitat, Desiree found that non-native ornamental plants support 75% less caterpillar biomass than native ornamentals. How did this loss of bird food impact chickadees? It clobbered them. When yards contain more than 30% non-native plants by biomass, the average percentage of non-natives in the yards she studied was 56%. Chickadees were 60% less likely to breed at all, and if they did try, they were unable to produce enough young to sustain their population. The good news from her study is that we now have a target to shoot for when designing our landscapes. Desiree's study suggests that we can support breeding bird populations indefinitely as long as at least 70% of the plants in our yards are productive native species. The next step is to test whether the composition of native plant species in our yards makes a difference in this regard. For example, will yards with native oaks, cherries, willows, and birches support more birds than yards with spicebush, ironwood, black gum, and Kentucky coffee trees? The latter are all native species, but they differ markedly in the number of caterpillar species that use them. Our prediction is that yards with plant species that support oodles of caterpillars will also support more breeding birds, but we need to measure it to be sure. Any birder worth her salt already knows where to look for spring migrants. Look to the oaks. Can millions of birders be consistently wrong? I doubt it. But again, it never hurts to measure such things. And that is what Christy Beal, another of my students, did a few years back. Controlling for tree size, Christy compared the number of minutes warblers foraged among 15 different genera of trees during spring migration in New Jersey. Warblers forage 3 times longer in oaks than in pines, the next closest competitor, and 6 times longer in oaks than in birches. They spent very little time foraging in any of the other 12 tree genera. Keep in mind that birds don't care two whits which tree they forage in as long as there is food there. They do, however, care about foraging efficiency. They cannot afford to waste time and energy searching for food where it doesn't exist. So they stay in unproductive trees as long as you would shop in Acme if all the shelves were bare, only a few seconds. My point here is simple. Cindy and I enjoy the passage of migrants and the frenetic but hopeful work of breeding birds in our yard because we have trees like oaks that produce the insect food these birds need. And you can too. And the title of this next part is called Inchworms in the Sky. In most of the country, May is the first month that you can walk into your yard and prove to yourself that oaks are great caterpillar producers. May is also the month that you will encounter the stiffest competition when hunting caterpillars on your oaks, because that's when most migrants stop in your yard to refuel on caterpillars, and when resident birds have started to breed, feeding hundreds of caterpillars each day to their growing chicks. I often get puzzled looks when I talk about certain plants making caterpillars, but if you think about it, that pretty well describes what is happening. Caterpillars are built from the energy and nutrients stored in the leaves they have eaten. In effect, caterpillars are repurposed leaves that can walk. Plants that have developed a co-evolutionary relationship with lots of species of moths and butterflies make or produce more caterpillars than plants that have not. Fortunately for birds, the caterpillars they like most, the smooth-skinned, tasty inchworms in the family Geometridae, are, or at least used to be, plentiful in the spring. Species like the porcelain gray, the fringed looper, the one-spotted variant, and the fall cankerworm, so named because the adults emerge and lay their eggs in the fall, can be so abundant on oaks that they occasionally trigger a homeowner's knee-jerk reaction to spray, purportedly in order to save the tree. But I suspect the real reason is that many of us don't like the little green worms parachuting into our hair. Be that as it may, spraying your caterpillars sets in motion a chain reaction that ends in local ecological disaster. When we spray a tree to kill caterpillars, we first kill all natural enemies of those caterpillars, which are more susceptible to our insecticides than the target caterpillars. Spraying rarely kills all the caterpillars, so the following year, there's an explosion of caterpillars because there are not enough predators and parasitoids around to keep their numbers down. So we spray again. The predators that eat caterpillars include local birds that were unable to raise young the previous year because we had killed the caterpillars they feed their young. Consequently, each year we spray, there are fewer birds around to control caterpillar populations, and so we spray again. Soon, we're locked into spraying toxins all over our properties every year because we have eliminated the natural controls that kept those caterpillars in check. All this to save trees that are well adapted to spring caterpillar flushes and, unless otherwise stressed, would not have been harmed by the caterpillars in the first place. I'm going to read you a summary of research that was done at the Kickapoo Reserve by Eric Wood. And this was published in January of 2010. It's titled, Can Wisconsin's Wood Warblers Cope with the Loss of Oaks? Published in the SILVIS, S-I-L-V-I-S lab, which is Spatial Analysis for Conservation and Sustainability, University of Wisconsin-Madison. Across the upper Midwest, oak forests and savannas are being replaced by development, agriculture, and by other tree species whose germination does not depend on the fires that once regularly occurred in southern Wisconsin and other states with oak savannas. SILVIS researcher Eric Wood is working to find out how migrating wood warblers might be affected by declines in oak in western Wisconsin. While his fieldwork is ongoing, preliminary results indicate that the arrival of some species coincides with oak flowering, suggesting the importance of these trees to warblers. The forests and savannas of Wisconsin are undergoing tremendous changes, according to Eric Wood, a researcher and graduate student at the SILVIS lab at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. On one side, there is a warming climate and accompanying changes in phenology, the timing of biological events, such as leafing out, flowering, and arthropod emergence. And on another, there are changes in the landscape, such as fire suppression and urbanization. One very visible consequence of these changes is that forests and savannas that were once dominated by oak species are being replaced by red maples, sugar maples, basswood, and other more shade-tolerant species. While this is happening in Wisconsin, a lack of oak regeneration is also occurring in other forests on the western slope of the Appalachians, the upper Midwest, and in the oak woodlands of California. A wide variety of organisms inhabit oak woodland, so it is important to understand how they use oak habitat and what the consequences of its loss might mean for them. Among the most diverse and colorful groups of North American songbirds are the wood warblers, which number some 30 species, of which 15 or so are the long-distance neotropical migrants that use the woodlands of Woods, Fort McCoy, and Kickapoo Valley Reserve study sites. While most of them breed further north in Canada, they heavily use Wisconsin resources on their journey north. Migration stopover is really understudied by ecologists. We don't know how different trees are used by migrating birds and how a loss of oaks will affect the migration of birds, says Wood, a California-born avian ecologist. While warblers that winter elsewhere in the U.S. appear more flexible in their diet, the neotropical warblers really seem tied to flowering and leaf-out events of oaks and other associated trees, continues Wood. Wood's team studies foraging behavior of birds in tree oak canopies, comparing their use and success in finding food in different tree species. He also is using wire cages to compare the invertebrate abundance and diversity found in areas of trees where birds are excluded from foraging with areas where they are not. It is challenging and tedious work to sort through, identify, and tally invertebrates from these comparative treatments. Wood has observed a link between oak catkin maturation and the arrival of the migrating wood warblers. According to Wood, it is unknown what proximate cues warblers respond to when selecting stopover locations. Many other questions intrigue Wood, who plans to continue warbler research at a broader scale and tie his work to studies of climate change, phenology, and ecosystem services. For example, Wood wonders whether the warblers are providing a valuable service to the oaks by relieving them of the burden of insects that consume their catkins. And for much more up-to-date information on what Eric Wood is studying, he's long since earned his PhD. Google Eric Wood, the Wood Lab, and there's a nice website. He's working in Los Angeles now on migrants and their foraging habits. So I'll end there. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thanks for listening.